5:55 was Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting. Serbs say they are overwhelmed after Hungary closed a key border crossing. Serbia's foreign minister said his nation is no longer able to handle the influx of migrants. Ivica Dačić declared that his country is not a collection center for refugees. He said it is unacceptable for migrants arriving from Greece and Macedonia to be forced to return to Serbia. Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban said that under new security measures, his administration will be tough on those who cross the border illegally. Those who enter Hungary without permission could be sentenced up to 3 years in prison. Police have already detained about 175 people. U.S. lawmakers say the United States must help address Syria's humanitarian crisis. Michael Bowman takes a look.
The chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Bob Corker, says the United States cannot turn a blind eye to the plight of Syrian migrants.
We bear some responsibility for what's happening.
Like many Republicans, Corker says inaction by the Obama administration helped fuel the current crisis. The main culprit, according to Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy, is Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Leahy applauded President Barack Obama's plan to admit 10,000 Syrian migrants. Michael Bowman, The Capitol.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said Russian military aid to Syria could serve to make the conflict in that country worse. Kerry spoke Tuesday with his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov. Kenya's National Commission on Human Rights is accusing police and security forces of numerous rights violations, including murder and torture, in the country's ongoing fight against terrorism. This is VOA News. A White House spokesman Tuesday warned North Korea against engaging in provocations.
We will repeat our call that North Korea should refrain from irresponsible provocations that aggravate regional tensions and should focus instead on fulfilling its international obligations and commitments.
The White House issued the statement after North Korea warned that it is ready to use nuclear weapons against the United States, quoting now, at any time. South Korea says it will proceed with preparations for inter-Korean family reunion events despite rocket threats by North Korea. A South Korean unification ministry official told reporters Tuesday the government will do its best to prepare for the event, which is slated to begin in late October. Senior members of the Taliban have announced the resolution of a potential split within the group's leadership. The split followed the death of previous leader Mullah Omar. The various Taliban factions all pledged allegiance Tuesday to the group's new leader, Mullah Akhtar Mansour. The U.S. government special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan said he hopes peace talks between the Taliban and the government in Kabul can resume soon. Thai police have for the first time publicly linked last month's bombing in Bangkok to China's Uyghur minority group. Investigators said Tuesday they believe the bombing of a Bangkok shrine was the revenge attack carried out by human traffickers who smuggled Uyghurs through Thailand. The U.S. company General Electric says it is moving 500 jobs to China, France, and Hungary because the U.S. Congress blocked a government program allowing foreign companies to borrow money to buy American products. Authorization for the lending programs at the U.S. Export-Import Bank ended July 1st when attempts to renew the funding for the agency failed. Some Republicans in Congress objected to the bank, saying it benefits large corporations that can find funding for their products in private markets and do not need government help. A civilian member of the United Nations mission in the Central African Republic has been accused of sexual misconduct. It is the 17th allegation in the past 17 months involving peacekeepers. Victims of the abuse have been as young as 11. Two political novices, real estate mogul Donald Trump and former neurosurgeon Ben Carson, topped the latest survey as the choice of U.S. Republicans for the party's 2016 presidential nomination. As the 16-candidate Republican field gets set for another round of debates Wednesday night, the CBS New York Times poll released Tuesday shows Trump with 27% support nationally, Carson trailing with 23%. From the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Boateng in Washington. Today is Wednesday, September 16th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Russia and Angola delay South Sudan targeted sanctions at the United Nations.
The impunity will only continue in South Sudan as it has for the last 21 plus months of this conflict without serious consequences for these high-level officials who are responsible for ceasefire violations and other human rights abuses.
Lindsay Hutchinson is a South Sudan policy analyst. South Sudan's President Salva Kiir says he's fully committed to the latest peace agreement, even while saying he still has reservations. President Mugabe delivers a wrong speech to Parliament, and a United Nations official warns of mass atrocities in Burundi.
I want to be very honest. Trying to sound a very urgent cautionary call to the international community not to wait until we have another tragedy.
Pablo de Greff is the UN Special Investigator on mass violations. Tunisia, the birthplace of the Arab Spring, continues to suffer growing pains, and will preview Pope Francis' visit to the United States next week. Those stories, plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Russia and Angola moved Tuesday to delay the imposition of targeted United Nations sanctions on leading South Sudan government and rebel officials obstructing peace in South Sudan. This came as three human rights organizations, Enough Project, Human Rights Watch, and Amnesty International, called on the Security Council to impose targeted sanctions on individuals responsible for crimes and human rights violations in South Sudan. Lindsay Hutchinson, a South Sudan policy analyst for Enough Project, says her organization is disappointed by the Russian and Angolan action. She says blocking targeted sanctions undermines the Security Council's pledge to impose serious consequences for those standing in the way of peace in South Sudan.
The impunity will only continue in South Sudan as it has for the last 21 plus months of this conflict without serious consequences for these high-level officials who are responsible for ceasefire violations and other human rights abuses.
You talk about targeted sanctions. When I say you, I mean Enough Project and the other human rights groups are talking about targeted sanctions. So what type of sanctions would you like to see be imposed on South Sudan officials?
So the targeted sanctions that we're calling for, that South Sudan needs right now, are targeted sanctions against individuals, which would involve travel bans and asset freezes of those individuals. It's not a blanket sanction against the entire country or against South Sudanese people themselves. It would be sanction, including a travel ban and an asset freeze, against those responsible who have been designated by the Security Council.
Do you have anybody in mind? Or are you talking about President Salva Kiir, Riek Machar? Because as you know, the United Nations already has some sanctions on some military people in South Sudan.
Yes. So on July 1st, the original six people were sanctioned. The problem with those sanction designations is that those people are ground commanders without a lot of assets outside of South Sudan. Whereas the two individuals today that the Security Council was considering sanctioning, Paul Malong and Johnson Ohlone, are both very high-level officials with assets outside of the country that could very easily be seized by several international institutions and governments, including their houses or their bank accounts. So it would have a huge deterrence effect.
South Sudan leaders have repeatedly said that sanctions are counterproductive to the peace process. And President Kiir said Tuesday that he's fully committed to ending the conflict. So why call for sanctions?
We hope and we fully support that these leaders are completely committed to ending the conflict and to achieving a sustainable peace. But right now, with ceasefire violations as they have been and other reports that the international community is getting, they're not proving that they're actually committed. They can't be empty words. There needs to be consequences. There needs to be a true commitment on the part of the South Sudanese government, the opposition, and all sides to actually end this fighting.
Secretary General Ban Ki-moon on Tuesday extended an invitation to President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar to come to the Security Council this month. What do you make of that?
I think it's a positive thing in bringing them together to the table to talk more and to have it be in a neutral environment. And they need to show the people of South Sudan and the world that they are both committed to this.
Lindsay Hutchinson is a South Sudan policy analyst for Enough Project. She was speaking with me from Washington, D.C. South Sudan President Salva Kiir says he's still fully committed to the peace process to end his country's year-old civil war. But in a nationwide speech Tuesday, Mr. Kiir said he continues to have serious reservations about the agreement. Still, the president said he signed the agreement for the good of South Sudan and its people. Nabil Biagio has details from Juba.
Mr. Kiir began his remarks by greeting all South Sudanese at home and abroad in refugee camps and sheltering inside UN bases. He made a point of including the rebels who government forces fought in the 20-month conflict in his greeting.
As the leaders of and citizens of this country, this is the time for us to come together despite our political differences, which made us fall apart and brought too much sufferings, humiliations and great damage to our country.
But then he took on a different tone, insisting that he still has reservations with the peace deal that IGAD spent nearly 2 years putting together. Mr. Kiir says he only signed the deal after coming under intense pressure to do so.
Because I put the interests of my people and country first, I refuse to succumb to the pressures which was mounted on me by IGAD, the Troika, AU, and those who wanted to run the affairs of our country by remote controls from their capitals.
The president says one of the biggest points of contention that he has with the deal is that it maintains divisions in South Sudan's main political party, the SPLM. He says the IGAD Plus mediation team ignored an effort in Arusha to reunify the SPLM, which is split into different factions when South Sudan plunged into conflict in December 2013.
This IGAD prescribed peace document is the most divisive and unprecedented peace deal ever seen in history of our country and the African continent at large.
Mr. Kiir also slammed the peace deal for undermining South Sudan's sovereignty. In particular, the president railed against a provision in the deal calling for an independent monitoring and evaluation committee to be set up to make sure the peace deal is being respected. But Mr. Kiir says that in spite of his reservations, his government will abide by the peace agreement.
With that signature, I had fully committed myself and the government to the faithful implementation of the agreement. All the institutions of government in the country shall be bound by this agreement and shall be expected to carry out the functions stipulated for them therein.
He says he believes that the deal could bring lasting peace to South Sudan and could end once and for all the seemingly incessant rivalry for the highest position in the land, the presidency. But he warned that the road ahead will not always be smooth. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
A UN special investigator says Burundi could slip back into open warfare unless the international community takes urgent preventive action. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva, where the investigator submitted his report.
Pablo de Greiff, a UN special investigator on mass violations, says much has happened since he visited Burundi in December, and none of it good. He says Burundi has turned away from the peaceful path it had followed since the 2000 Arusha agreement that ended the country's civil war. He says the government of President Pierre Nkurunziza is no longer attempting to build a society based on the rule of law, and that the tradition of impunity from past decades has become further entrenched and is being used as a tool of repression and violence. De Greiff says he presented his concerns to the UN Human Rights Council in hopes that member states understand the gravity of the situation unfolding in Burundi and take measures to head off a disaster.
Here, I want to be very honest, trying to sound a very urgent cautionary call to the international community not to wait until we have another tragedy in our hands before we take action.
Some 3,000 people were killed in Burundi during the civil war. The country was relatively peaceful in recent years until the end of April, when the president announced he would seek a controversial third term. Since then, de Graaf says, there have been more than 100 killings, hundreds of arbitrary arrests, and many cases of torture and ill treatment. He says none of these cases is being investigated except for one that involves a government official. The president was re-elected in July, but tension remains between his supporters and those who say he violated the two-term limit in the Constitution. The UN investigator says the international community and regional governments cannot afford to simply stand by and wait for new mass atrocities to recur in Burundi. He warns this would risk a major conflict in the Great Lakes region with unpredictable and frightening results. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Today's Wednesday, September 16th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Let's give a shout-out to listeners on our affiliate station, Radio Hot Cocoa in Bamenda, Cameroon. Daybreak Africa time, 16 minutes past the hour. Yesterday's official opening of the third session of Zimbabwe's parliament was a comedy of errors, beginning with President Robert Mugabe delivering an old speech, which was not broadcast live as usual to the surprise of television viewers and radio listeners in the country. Erwin Chifera of VOA Zimbabwe Service reports from Harare.
Today's opening of Parliament started well, with state media reporting that all was set for President Robert Mugabe's speech to Parliament. The usual praise singers comprising Zanu-PF supporters, members of the Repository, and others sang and ululated outside Parliament when President Mugabe arrived with his wife, Grace, in a vintage black Rolls Royce. He inspected the guard of honor as Air Force of Zimbabwe jets flew past. A 21-gun salute was also fired as part of the proceedings ahead of the speech. The Zimbabwe Broadcasting Corporation had set up its outside broadcasting equipment and deployed staff a day ahead to prepare for the much-publicized event. However, events took a dramatic turn when a spat ensued between the chief whip of the opposition, MDC, led by Morgan Tsvangirai, and Speaker of the House over allegations raised by MDC chief whip Innocent Gonese that they'd received death threats against any member planning to embarrass the president by heckling him, as happened at last month's State of the Nation address. It was then that the ZBC staffers were ordered not to broadcast the event live. More drama followed when the usually poised and meticulous President Mugabe took to the podium and began delivering an old speech. For instance, Mr. Mugabe referred to the state of the economy in the speech.
The economic growth rate, which was initially projected at 3.2%, is now expected to register 1.5% growth in 2015.
In explanation, presidential spokesman George Aramba acknowledged there was a mix-up in his office leading to a delay in the correct speech that President Mugabe delivered later than expected. Viewers and onlookers seeking an explanation for the abrupt cessation of the broadcast received none by ZBC staffers who cannot be named as they are not allowed to speak to the press that they had received a directive not to go live. However, this was reported before it was known that the president's speech was the wrong one. Reporting from Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
A top U.S. State Department official says Tunisia is under tremendous pressure from terrorist attacks as it works to build and act democratic reforms. Assistant Secretary for Democracy, Human Rights and Labor Tom Malinowski, who visited Tunis this month, tells VOA some of that pressure is from neighboring Libya, where attacks by Islamist State-affiliated militants have worsened the region's instability. VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins reports.
Tunisia has done many of the right things, including holding free elections and creating space for civil society, says Assistant Secretary Tom Malinowski, But he warns these reforms are being challenged.
It is under tremendous pressure right now from a wave of terrorist attacks, which I think are targeting Tunisia precisely because it's taken these courageous steps forward in democracy.
In June, a gunman killed 38 people in Tunisia's coastal resort city of Sousse. Tunisian authorities say the gunman trained at a militant camp in Libya.
Tunisia is cursed in part by being close to Libya. It shares a very long border with Libya, and given the situation in Libya with ISIL gaining a foothold in parts of that country, the chaos that we are trying to end or mitigate, it has created a situation that Tunisia is bearing the brunt of.
To lessen the impact of Libya's instability, Tunisia is building a wall along part of its border with the country.
Terrorists can get trained in Libya, weapons can get smuggled between Libya and Tunisia. The border is pretty much open.
Analyst Karim Mezran says he does not believe in walls. Instead, he favors better investment in Libya to help the country deal with instability. Also, say other analysts like Sarah Foyer, some of Tunisia's problems are internal.
It can build all the walls that it wants, and I certainly sympathize with the impulse to do that. But at some point, it also has to deal with security threats emanating from within its borders.
Thousands of Islamic State fighters in Iraq and Syria are thought to be from Tunisia. Foyer says the best thing the U.S. can do to help Tunisia is continue to back its political reforms.
Tunisia's trying to proceed along this bumpy path to democracy. And the concern is that it's harder to do that if you have a real security threat emanating.
Malinowski says Washington has been stepping up assistance to Tunisia to help the government better monitor the flow of people in and out of the country and get better intelligence information. Pam Dawkins, VOA News, the State Department.
Pope Francis' statements on climate change, economic inequality, and immigration have all spiced up the political debate in the United States. But when he arrives in the United States on Tuesday, September 22nd, for a five-day visit, Pope Francis will find deep divisions within the U.S. Catholic Church over the main message of his papacy. VOA religion correspondent Jerome Sokolowski reports from Philadelphia.
A place that calls itself the City of Brotherly Love is gearing up to welcome a pope who has preached love and acceptance. But that's not the message Suzanne Cassidy got when she met the Archbishop of Philadelphia.
Something like, if we didn't really believe in all of the church teaching, that we maybe shouldn't consider ourselves Catholics.
Cassidy has two gay sons and believes the church is wrong on homosexuality. In fact, surveys show a majority of American Catholics agree and hold views on abortion and birth control that also deviate from doctrine. And many of these Catholics feel Francis is on their side.
I understand the Pope is maybe not going to change church teaching, at least right now, but his words of telling people to be kinder and to use proper words and not to use the words, language is so important.
The Archbishop, Charles Chepute, has been cast as the anti-Francis after he approved of a teacher at this Catholic school being fired because she was married to another woman. Chepute spoke at a conference of religion reporters last month about the papal visit, but declined to be interviewed for this story. But Cardinal Joseph Kurtz, president of the U.S. Bishops' Conference, says people are getting the wrong idea about the Pope.
Sometimes the reporting of what Pope Francis says is cast in a way that sounds like a change in doctrine. And he clarifies that clearly, that he's looking for new pastoral ways to accompany people.
He is reaching out to those who are angry or separated, not because he is watering down or changing the teachings, but because he's saying there really is something beautiful here in his teachings about family that will help you come to know God.
A century ago, this historic city received waves of Catholic immigrants. But even a dyed-in-the-wool Catholic like Cassidy lost faith in the hierarchy when clergy were put on trial for sex abuse.
for me, it was like, oh my gosh, like you believed in everything, you know, and all of a sudden now it was hard to believe in anything for me.
Philadelphia has been a bastion of American Catholicism, and the church is still recovering from years of scandal and mismanagement. Francis will get to see firsthand what the faith is up against in the city of brotherly love. Jerome Sokolowski, VOA News, Philadelphia.
It's 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we focus on the All-Africa Games in Brazzaville, Republic of Congo. Starting with volleyball, Algeria dismissed Republic of Congo in three straight sets to retain the men's volleyball crown on Tuesday. Egypt edged Rwanda 3-2 in the bronze medal playoff. In women's game, Kenya beat Cameroon by 3-1 to claim the gold medal, while Egypt dismissed Seychelles in three straight sets to clinch the bronze medal. Turning to athletics, Kenyan Grace Wanjiru clocked 1 hour 38 minutes and 28 seconds to establish a championship record in women's 20-kilometer race walking on Tuesday. The previous record of 1 hour 40 minutes and 35 seconds was by Tunisia's Trabelsi Chaima in Maputo, Mozambique in 2011. In Brazzaville, South African Lebohang Shange prevailed in men's 20-kilometer race walking. On the track, Zambian Kabange Mupopo was victorious in women's 400 meters. She also improved her Zambian national record in a lifetime best of 50.22 seconds. Botswana's Isaac Makwala won the men's 400 meters in 44.35 seconds. Ethiopian Sofia Assefa prevailed in women's 3,000-meter steeplechase. Nigerian women bagged three gold medals through Kelechi Nwanaga in javelin, Amusan Oluwatobiloba in 100-meter hurdles, and the 4x100-meter relay. The results of the men's 4x100-meter relay will be confirmed today, Wednesday, by the technical delegate following a review of the recorded race. In basketball, Angola edged Cameroon 58-51 in women's quarterfinals on Tuesday. Mali beat Ivory Coast 73-45. Nigeria outwitted Gabon 73-65 as Senegal dismissed Mozambique 65-46. Algeria beat Republic of Congo 64-42 in a classification match, while in the men's game, Ivory Coast beat Gabon 70-51 in a classification fixture. Meanwhile, Nigeria pipped Angola 23-21 in men's handball on Tuesday. Republic of Congo edged Ivory Coast 29-26 as Egypt outwitted the Democratic Republic of Congo 26-20. Finally, in football, in the women's contest, Ghana pipped Ivory Coast 1-0 as Cameroon edged Nigeria 2-1 in semifinal action to set up a repeat of the final 4 years ago in Maputo, Mozambique. In the men's semifinals, Burkina Faso upset Nigeria 3-1 as Senegal beat Republic of Congo 3-1. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Wednesday morning, September 16th.
Dear viewer, please permit me to call on our brothers and sisters at the IDP camps in Nigeria to be more security conscious. It will help us save lives at the camp. The IDPs, please do not wait for security agents to come and man the camps. They have a lot to do. Prevention is better than cure. Comrade Mazi Patrick Okoro Crow for all blue premises at an outskirts of the state, Nigeria.
Thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. And briefly, before we leave you a summary of Africa news, a civilian member of the United Nations mission in the Central African Republic has been accused of sexual misconduct. That is it for this Wednesday, September 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Botti in Washington saying, have a lovely day, Africa.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, Shaka Sali goes one-on-one with Uganda's Minister for Foreign Affairs, Sam Kutesa, the outgoing President of the United Nations General Assembly. The 69th session ends Tuesday. Mr. Kutesa will be with us live next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on Straight Talk Africa. That's next time on VOA Africa.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time
with David Bandy.